Our speaker today is Sarah Bronan. I first became aware of Sarah Bronan in 2021 when she gave a webinar sponsored by St. Anselm's College and introduced the idea of the Zoning Atlas. Sarah Bronan was one of the founders of Desegregate Connecticut, which was a coalition of people engaged in discovering how to provide more equitable housing in the state of Connecticut. And people kept saying, well, how do you know that you can't build a duplex there? So as a response to that, they created what was then just the Zoning Atlas for Connecticut. And by reading 32,000 pages of zoning code, it's just as much fun. I think it's fun, but I'm pretty sure no one else does. 32,000 pages of zoning code, they were able to put together an interactive map where you could type in, where in Connecticut can I build a duplex? And the answer is really few places. And out of the Connecticut Zoning Atlas came the National Zoning Atlas work, when more than 20 states now have at least part of their state, the codes entered in so that you can see, where can I build a duplex? Where can I build a fourplex? How much of my state or my city is restricted to single family only housing? All of those things are questions that need to be answered as we work to think about how our zoning works or doesn't work for us. She served on the Planning Commission for the City of Hartford for a number of years, and as a former Planning Board Chair, I am deeply impressed. That's a hard job to have. But one of the things that I am most grateful for Sarah Bronan is the book that she finished relatively recently called Key to the City. Key to the City is the best primer that I've come across for introducing lay people to the idea of how zoning shapes the places we live. And whether it shapes them in the way that we want it to. You know, what are the levers that we have available to us? So I am grateful to be here with Sarah this morning. I can't wait to hear what she has to say. I'm sure that it's going to have to do with creating beautiful, equitable, comfortable places for everyone to live. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Ivy, for that very kind introduction. And I can't imagine a better moderator, somebody with deep expertise in planning and zoning and city making, town making, and politics, which I think is actually really essential to understanding how zoning works. But before I begin, I'd also just like to thank the Lyceum and Bob Herring Smith and all of those who made my visit possible today. It's always wonderful to be in New Hampshire. I spent a lot of time in Connecticut, not too far away. But the roots of my book, and I'll turn to that now, really come from my growing up much farther away in Houston, Texas, where I just spent 3 weeks of the summer. My parents still live there. And Houston, how many of you have been to Houston, Texas? Okay, a good number of you. I hope you had some really good Mexican food there. Has some great food. But Houston happens to have the distinction of being the only large American city without zoning. So for those of you who are unfamiliar with what zoning is local land use regulation. We call it land use regulation, but zoning not just dictates land uses, it also tells a community where zoning that has adopted zoning how lots can be developed, and it also almost always has rules about how the structures on those lots, the structures within the community, can be developed. So zoning pulls a lot of levers, as Ivy called them, and I'll talk about a few in a moment. But in general, it is the thing that orders our communities for better or for worse. Houston is one of those places that lacks any land use controls in the way zoning is traditionally understood. It does have a few subdivision regulations and parking requirements that are embedded in the code of ordinances in Houston. But if you've been there, you know what I'm talking about when I say it's a very disjointed place. It has, and I talk about this a bit in the book, where I grew up, right across from the street, right across the street from my building, was a gas station, a nightclub, a self-storage facility, a strip mall, lots of parking and pavement, no trees. But because it was an unzoned city, this sense of disorder could pop up, and certainly did, not just on my block where I grew up, but all throughout the city. And being back there for 3 weeks last month really made that point hit home. You know, I wrote the book in 2023, 2024, and this was the first time I'd been really back after the book had been published. I did a book talk in Houston, and actually published something in the Houston Chronicle, which is the big paper there, and the title of the article, the op-ed and excerpt of my book said, "It's time to talk about zoning again." The people of Houston have put zoning on the ballot 3 times, and each time it was rejected, the last time in 1993. And the theory of rejecting zoning there was that if you have zoning, it's going to constrain property rights, it's going to eliminate our freedoms, and it's going to make things more expensive. I argue in the book that there are plenty of people who would like zoning to go away, that would like to have a free-for-all environment like Houston. But I argue that that is a misguided idea, and that zoning, for all of the bad that it's done in this country, is actually a force that can be used for good. And even in Houston, where people are very innovative and can handle complex challenges, I sort of threw the gauntlet down in this op-ed and said, Houston could probably be the place where we have a totally new approach to zoning, using the levers available and making the city more orderly, more beautiful, and more equitable. Because right now, what happens in Houston is any of the bad uses, the factories, the Budweiser plant, the refineries, those go, as you might predict, next to low-income neighborhoods, neighborhoods predominantly people of color, and so on. So, just wanted to set that context for where I come from and how different it is from the town that we're in right now, which, like many New England towns, is a historic town. I mean, you can see history all around. I just did a little walk around this morning, and the connection to the river, the religious buildings here, the mix of commerce and other things, and the walkability of this little town center. I bet that's why you come here. I bet that's why you maybe live around here. I bet that's why you gravitate towards a place like this and a building like this that connects communities. I think Peterborough's built form on a very small scale is the kind of built form, the kind of built environment that we should be pushing more towards. And yet zoning in this country actually forces us to build outward. Now I'll go back to the zoning atlas in a minute. Thank you for raising that, because we have covered all of New Hampshire actually. And I'll also maybe say throw off a few stats. I just pulled it up on my phone so that I had all the stats when I wanted to come to that point in the presentation. But New Hampshire is a bit different than Connecticut zoning. It's a bit different than Vermont's and Massachusetts and Rhode Island zoning, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. But where my book starts, and again, rooted in Houston, rooted in this desire to see how land use laws can help shape our world, and you know, maybe flashbacks of a city that was very spread out, over 500 square miles. Houston is one city over 500 square miles. The driving, the strip malls, the sprawl, even within the city center. Moving to Hartford, another larger New England city, really gave me some perspective. I had lived in New Haven for a couple of years, and I know many of you are familiar with probably both cities. But Hartford is the place where, as Ivy said, I had the opportunity to serve on the Planning and Zoning Commission for 7 years, mostly as its chair. Just a few months, I was a regular member, but then I became chair shortly after that. And I had come to that position as a law professor, working at the University of Connecticut for a number of years. I had been a co-author of a zoning treatise and land use case books and did a lot of research on case law. But that did not really prepare me for the time on the Planning and Zoning Commission. And I knew that. And so stepping into that role as somebody who hadn't grown up in Hartford and I'd lived there for a few years, but I wasn't really familiar with every block in the city like you have to be for a person in that position. And so I asked people in the community to walk around with me and to show me their neighborhood in their eyes. And these were typically neighborhood leaders, and there were 15 neighborhood revitalization zones, and I walked every one of them with key leaders as well as people in cross-cutting organizations. But the book starts in the first chapter with the walk that I took with a woman named Denise Best. So Denise lived in a neighborhood that was, I would think, 97 to 98% African American and West Indian, one of the lowest income census tracts in the state, in one of the poorest cities in the country. Cutting her neighborhood in two was a wide thoroughfare, four lanes, a state road called Albany Avenue. And it had been widened over time. And the central purpose of Albany Avenue, which had once been the commercial thoroughfare in her neighborhood, that had for maybe centuries served the people in that community, had been widened and widened and designed and made convenient for the suburban commuters that were moving from the white, wealthy western suburbs of Hartford into the downtown, where the insurance companies and the financial services and the law firms and all of that is located, just like many downtowns. So just for context, Hartford has 125,000 people in a region of more than a million. And again, it is the poor central city, land constrained, because it cannot, unlike Houston and southern cities, annex land, so it is 17 square miles. So within that 17 square miles, the city makes its own land use decisions when it comes to zoning. And when Denise and I walked around that day, this is what we saw. So she lived in a two-story house with a nice porch and a gabled roof, like every other building on Deerfield Avenue, which is where she lives. And that avenue bisects Albany Avenue, so she could see Albany Avenue from her porch. And so we walked down to Albany Avenue, and immediately there was this smell of fried chicken, and that was because there was a Popeyes right around the corner. There's trash strewn about the street, really large curb cuts, no trees for shading, and curb cuts, those big driveways that, by the formula of fast food chains, have to be a certain width wide, and they have to be on the corner. So you not only get one curb cut, but you get two, you get a drive-through. And you get a lot of concrete and a lot of paving. So the Popeyes not only had that effect of the smell, the unsafe pedestrian environment that was dictated by the formulas of the fast food chains, but it also added to the heat that her community suffered from, because not only were the trees gone from Albany Avenue, but they were often gone from the side streets as well, just because of the way that development had happened, and because of the fact that nobody told people, well, maybe you should put back a tree, maybe you should plant a tree when you're doing something new. We kept going up and down the avenue, gas stations, car washes, other strip malls, one story set really far back from the street, mostly pavement, lots of curb cuts, not the kind of walkable community that you would expect, walkable street that you would expect as one of the main thoroughfares of this neighborhood in a city that was founded in 1635. So Hartford had, in effect, totally reversed what was its historical approach. When I left Denise, I was really struck by the observations that she had. And as the planning and zoning chair, I said, well, let me just see, you know, does it have anything to do with the zoning code? Is there any way we can address some of these issues? And sure enough, what I found in the zoning code, which had last been updated in the 1950s, was a series of levers, a series of requirements that actually made Albany Avenue the way that it was. One of those was the requirement that every use provide a certain number of parking spaces. So instead of having the 3- and 4-story brick buildings, there's a handful of those up and down the avenue that were built up to the sidewalk, these sort of handsome places. You had maybe one of those and then a parking lot. You had another one and then a parking lot. What had happened was, in the rush to cater to the suburban commuters, the rush to embrace the car in the 1950s and 60s, Hartford, like many cities around the country, had imposed these, again, in the zoning code, who would have noticed it, parking mandates that required people to build exactly what Denise was seeing, so asphalt parking spaces. And in doing so, to tear down buildings on the avenue to satisfy parking requirements. If you look at historic towns, historic main streets all over the country, you see that kind of development. We see there's an old building here, and then you see the parking lot, the old building in the parking lot. Hartford suffered from that too. But what's more, Hartford had actually changed its zoning code as well to facilitate, to fast track those gas stations and the fast food places. There's not a single sit-down restaurant on the avenue, as Denise liked to tell me. And we changed the zoning code to respond to that as well. I'll talk about that in a moment. But the zoning code itself, when I looked at it after walking with her, really mandated the results that she was seeing. It also had no requirements on provisions for trees. It had no provisions on aesthetics. It had no requirements, and as I said, zoning can dictate how buildings can be built. It had nothing about that. So Denise's neighborhood and that walk was just one of many that I took in and around Hartford, and each neighborhood had different issues, but they were all symptoms of the same problem, which is that the zoning code was really outdated, that it was built for the car and not for people in a very compact, again, 17-square-mile historic city. And so we set out to reverse that. So much of the book talks about stories from Hartford, and stories ranging from how we tackled mixed-use zoning for the mill buildings and industrial buildings. I know you probably have a couple around here that needed to be converted to new uses, but were zoned to be manufacturing. We took a survey of housing in Hartford, and even though a significant percentage, I think 40% of housing units in Hartford, are deed restricted to be affordable. So let that sink in. That is a huge number. And even though many of the region's poorest residents found housing in Hartford, there was still, and there is still remains now, a need to build new housing and renovate buildings for housing in Hartford. There is still a housing demand. And we know this because the vacancy rates downtown are past 96% year after year, no matter how much housing we build, and that prices continue to rise. So we also took a look citywide at how we could better provide housing through the zoning code. Previously in the code, it said that any apartments had to have a special permit, which means a public hearing, which meant developers wouldn't know necessarily if they would get their permit before they would build housing. We legalized all housing as of right in the city of Hartford, becoming, I think, the first major city to do that. And so what that means is that in the code, we said, if you want to build an apartment building, you can do it with a counter permit, work with staff, get your permit, but you have to follow certain requirements. So one of them, for example, is you would have to build the new building up to the street. You'd have to have a certain minimum number of stories. And through that form-based code, and I can talk more about that in the Q&A, we were able to come up with a system where we felt very comfortable, and neighborhood leaders, including Denise, felt very comfortable that they knew what somebody was going to build within the parameters that we put out in the code, and so why not allow them to build that housing with some certainty? So we tackled housing, we tackled trees. Denise's neighborhood, like many, did not have a robust tree canopy. So what we did in a chapter on trees and landscaping is that we mandated, so there's the word mandate, but again, in part trying to create a broader public good. But when somebody was pulling a zoning permit and building something new, they had to include in their landscaping plan trees with diverse species requirements, trees that were native and naturally occurring. We had a list of trees. And that has really started to help create more of that, what I call in the book, like an environmental service and a broad amenity that is important for the city and needs to be done incrementally and repeatedly again and again. One way to do that is through the zoning code. So we talked a bit about parking. The city also, through this rezoning effort that we did, eliminated parking mandates, becoming the first large city to do that as well. So in the book, I talk about the city of Buffalo, another large post-industrial city, much larger than Hartford. I talk about some small towns that have eliminated parking mandates. And in virtually every case, what that has done is that has enabled not cars and asphalt to be accommodated, but people and new uses, whether parking lots are now being converted to new buildings, something that we saw in a small town that I mentioned in Idaho, or whether, like is in the case of Buffalo and Hartford both, buildings that were one use are being converted to another use without triggering these mandates that require them to figure out how they're going to find parking. Moreover, the new housing that's been built in the city of Hartford has been done with parking that the developer knows will be needed for the development, as opposed to an outdated zoning code telling them how much parking they'll need. If a developer knows that they will or expects to need parking for their tenants, they will build it. Otherwise, they wouldn't be able to recoup the cost that they've invested in the development. So those are a few things that that we did in the overhaul that I would call the nuts and bolts, the essentials, the housing, the transportation. And I want to mention one last thing that I consider to be an essential thing that we did in the code that meets people's household security needs, and that is we addressed food. So my favorite chapter in the book, I think, is the chapter about food-related zoning. I love to eat. I came from a restaurant family. I spent every day working in my grandparents' restaurants from when I was born until high school. The chapter on food is really important to me because as working in Hartford, we worked a lot with the city's Food Policy Advisory Commission. And with a population like Hartford's, food insecurity is an issue in a large percentage, if not most, of the households in our city. Whether people can get fresh and healthy foods depends on a lot of things. But one thing it certainly depends on is whether the rules of the game, whether the land use rules would allow them to get that kind of, allow them to have that access. In Hartford, before we changed the code, urban agriculture was not mentioned and therefore, according to the terms of the code, was illegal. So what that meant is community gardens, urban farms, farmers markets, farm stands, even composting, hen keeping and beekeeping, all of it, if not explicitly illegal, was illegal by omission. Again, but that's what our code says. If it's not expressly allowed, it's prohibited. So we worked pretty extensively with the Food Policy Advisory Commission to identify, to define these uses, to identify best practices, and then adopted those into the Hartford Code, hopefully enabling a new flourishing for some of these uses, not just by individual renters and owners, but also by the nonprofits that know they need to and are actively creating opportunities for people to create their own food and have access to their own food and do it on a larger scale, including large-scale urban farm that is opened on city land. So that's about the essentials. I do want to talk a bit about, and I've focused on Hartford, but I should say that the book is not just about Hartford. For example, in the food chapter, I talk about Boston, where the Boston Common used to be the place where everybody would bring their sheep to graze. And in fact, Boston was a pretty agricultural city before zoning and other city ordinances outlawed urban agriculture there. Boston had a big renaissance in that regard, and that's actually what Hartford drew from in developing its code. Similarly, when it comes to housing and parking, looked at other cities around the country that have done, as I mentioned Buffalo, but that have done similar reforms. So on the essentials, there are a number of cities that I cover in the book. I also, in the book, talk about systems, the environment, and stormwater management, and some other maybe technical things. But I wanted to get to, in my last few minutes, the few chapters on delight. So how many, are there any architects in the room? People went to architecture school? In architecture school, in the very first class, at least at my university, we learned about the Roman architect Vitruvius, and who famously said, or famously to architecture students, there are three parts of a building, or three things that you have to keep track of as an architect. One is firmness, so the building has to be sound. One is commodity, it has to be useful. And then the third thing is delight. And I really think zoning codes should be thought of in a similar way. So how can you regulate delight? Well, I argue that there are ways to do that. And the reason to do that is that we are not just, you know, efficiency robots. I don't know, maybe we'll get that way at some point soon with this AI, you know, dominating our world. But we are people, and people respond to their environment, and people need and deserve to have beautiful places, fulfilling places, places that from a psychological standpoint, people study psychology, and some psychologists study how humans gravitate towards certain kinds of spaces, certain configurations, certain colors. Humans gravitate towards variety. They gravitate towards greenery. They gravitate towards walls. So what does that mean? It means probably that the kind of sprawl that we mandate, the large lot developments, the strip malls, again, that we basically write into our zoning codes almost everywhere, is not actually the way that people want to live, that people in their very animal, you know, back of their brain way really relate to their built environment. And so I argue in the book that we should draw from some of that research, and I don't go super deep into the research, but that we should use maybe common sense and create zoning codes that enable or facilitate a much more beautiful, delightful environment. And so one way to do that, I mentioned the form-based code that Hartford used. There are communities around the country, including Delray Beach, Florida, that happened to be the one that I zoomed into a bit in the book, which is a beach, I guess, community. It's a larger town, but it has an avenue and that leads straight to the beach, and it has all kinds of turquoises and peaches and purples and balconies and arcades that you can walk through. And wondering how that came about, you look at the zoning code, and the zoning code was adopted after a lot of that development, but the zoning code sort of locked that in place. And the zoning code has these different style, sort of a series of imaginative styles that it uses, and color recommendations, and you have to have an arcade so that people can have shade in the Florida heat and so on. So there are places that I think have responded in different ways. A Hartford is going to look very different than a Delray Beach, but use zoning to help create a, for lack of a better word, a style guide to buildings that create more coherent environments and that create those kinds of not only patterns but also sense of order and those walls that people need when they or people gravitate towards, as opposed to parking and then building behind. Another aspect of delight is the nightlife. So I have a chapter in the book about nightlife, and I don't know what nightlife is like here in Peterborough. I bet it gets pretty wild. But lots of communities do have a need to manage nightlife. So if you've been to Austin and you've been to Sixth Street, I actually use that as a failed example of nightlife management through zoning. Because what zoning has done on 6th Street, which is, I went to college at UT Austin, I admit in the book that I didn't spend a lot of time on 6th Street, probably to my social detriment. But what it is basically like a Bourbon Street. It's like a series of bars and nightclubs and things like that. Especially after the advent of South by Southwest, it became very commercialized, very sort of high volume drinking corridor. I don't know if a better way to say that, but it has deteriorated, and business leaders in downtown have confirmed that the fact that the zoning only locks in those kinds of nighttime-oriented uses and doesn't either require or facilitate more uses like stores or shops or things that could happen during the daytime and maybe be compatible with even a strip of nightlife has meant that it's sort of a no man's land during the day, and then at night it comes alive, but it comes alive with people with maybe, you know, I don't know, a concentration of debauchery, for lack of a better word, that then spills out into neighboring developments, including places that nice restaurants and hotels. And so my point in talking about Austin was really that the city, through zoning, can actually create a new playbook for this strip in a way that actually enables it to once again contribute to the surrounding downtown instead of what it is now, which is sort of an isolated 6-hour instead of 24-hour active space. I contrast that a bit with Nashville and its nightlife, which is more dispersed and which has been complemented by, which is very active, I should say, but it's been complemented by housing developments and conversions and revitalization of historic buildings that had for a really long time been vacant. So nightlife, that's one aspect of it. Another aspect is adult uses, and I'm happy to talk more about that in the Q&A, but in that part of the chapter, I use Baltimore, which concentrates its adult uses to one block in downtown. Adult uses meaning like cabarets and adult bookstores and things that 18 and over type establishments. But they concentrate them under the watchful eye of the police department one block away. Other communities disperse them, and they have dispersion requirements. And these have been litigated all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, which has basically said every community has to allow adult uses, and then how you allow it, and they set out a few rules that I talk about in the book. So nightlife, it's part of many communities. It is certainly a struggle when it comes to zoning, and to the extent it's a live issue in Peterborough and surrounding areas, I'd love to talk about that too. The last thing I'll say is this straddles both, I think, sort of essential systems, that functionality piece, but then also the delight piece, which is the role of nature. And for me, zoning is not just about, again, creating the essentials or creating delight, but creating beautiful places. And I do think we lost a bit when we lose a bit when we don't harness zoning. And every person and every development that comes in for a zoning permit, to use that development to beautify, to add. And so the tree component I've talked about. And I do want to just talk a bit about stormwater management. I'm from Houston, after all. It's a swamp. Stormwater management is huge. And maybe if it had a zoning code, entire neighborhoods would not get flooded and swept away every time there's a hurricane, which is frequent. But Burlington, Vermont is an example that I use, talk about in the book, and the way that they have redesigned their downtown to not only manage stormwater, which is important to satisfy the city's mandate from the EPA to clean up Lake Champlain because of the runoff from the streets into the lake, but also to beautify the downtown. And they're seeing progress. I know they're building out streets, but they have a plan to do that. And they can do it both through city ordinance on street design, but also through zoning. So in general, I make the case that that zoning is a powerful tool, that it can be used at scale. It can be used to beautify our streets, our sidewalks, the public realm. It can be used to create things that we need. And it can be used to provide more environmentally fulfilling, environmentally sensitive developments. So with that, I'm just going to mention briefly the National Zoning Atlas and in my last couple minutes and just say, actually, New Hampshire was very kind to us. New Hampshire only had 21,870 pages of zoning codes. And our partners in that, St. Anselm College and others, actually some state agencies and state entities that pitched in. But Max Latona, professor there, is really the quarterback of that effort and has been a wonderful partner. So New Hampshire has 247 jurisdictions with zoning, according to our atlas. 232 of them have zoning. That means 15 of them don't exercise zoning. That's more that don't exercise zoning than in Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island, where you just have one or two. Across the state, just to give you some stats, so the book is really about stories and the zoning atlas is about stats, but across the state in New Hampshire, 96% of residential land allows for single family housing as of right. That means, as I was talking about, no public hearing, you go for the permit, you submit your permit, you might even get it that day. Whereas 3% of residential land allows for three or more family housing as of right. So 96 to 3%, that's a big difference and speaks a bit to the housing shortage issues that you might be facing here. Statewide, 62% of single family land requires 80,000 square feet or more. Okay, so let me just say that again. So 62% of land requires more than a football field for each house. So then you wonder, well, why when I drove in, you saw lots of sort of sprawling developments, single houses on pretty large lots. People want to live that way in some cases. In New Hampshire, you're requiring people to live that way and not necessarily providing a lot of other options. And St. Anselm has actually done some really great reports about this, showing the very small amount of land in New Hampshire where you can build a house on a small lot. Small lots are good not only for affordability, but also for the environment, because you're not pushing out into farmland and agricultural land. And then just last thing, you might say, well, that might be only in, you're talking about all of New Hampshire, so a lot of it is rural. But those same stats hold true in the Manchester metro area. In fact, in Manchester, the Manchester metro, which I think is big metro right here, 69% of land in the metro requires 80,000 square feet or more for a house. So it's even worse somehow in the metro areas. And then those stats on housing units in the Manchester area, 97% allow single family housing, 1% of land allows for four or more family housing. So again, I could go on and on about the stats that we have in the map, and I'm happy to talk about them, and I'll busily pull them up if you need. I do have Peterborough pulled up as well. I'm not sure Peterborough alone will solve New Hampshire's housing shortage, but happy to talk about that too, especially if some of you actually are residents of this nice town. I think I'm actually going to end there and get to Q&A, but I really, really appreciate the time, and again, I'm excited to be here to talk about the book, but then also share any insights that I can about New Hampshire's zoning. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Sarah. And boy, howdy, am I glad to hear that call out for form-based code. As a person who writes form-based code and thinks that it can solve a lot of our problems, I have a question for you while we wait for other people's questions to arrive. A number of states have said that given that the average state in the United States has something like 300 different jurisdictions managing zoning, maybe we should try to fix some of these problems at the state level. Oregon is famous for having done this. The state of Wyoming has done this. I mean, there's some surprising states who have said, hey, you know what, towns? You can't mandate that you have to have a special exception in order to build a backyard cottage. So what's your take on statewide zoning mandates?
Well, I think in many states, legislators have come to understand that the pressing housing shortage issues and housing affordability issues are something that no town can do alone. I joke that Peterborough probably can't solve New Hampshire's housing issues alone, But that's, it's really true that we have devolved zoning. It would be nice, actually, if the average was 300 per state. There are 33,339 jurisdictions with zoning in the country that could have zoning, with zoning authority, that we've counted in the zoning atlas. So I think it's even more than that. We have states with over 2,000 individual jurisdictions with zoning. That's Minnesota, Ohio, I think Wisconsin is up there. New York has 1,500 jurisdictions that might have zoning. So when you think about the municipal fragmentation issue, and you think about the devolution of these powers to local governments, this happened in a wave in the 1920s when all states started to adopt state zoning enabling acts that looked pretty similar from one state to the other. And the theory was, well, we're going to take these powers that the state has and we're going to give them to local governments who know best. Well, 100 years later, I think many state lawmakers are reflecting and thinking, well, they didn't exactly do what we need for them to do so that we can achieve our goals as a state. So you are seeing a number of overrides, guidance, as I sometimes like to call it. And as Ivy said, you're seeing it in a lot of states. So Connecticut's legislature just passed pretty sweeping reforms in this regard. The governor shamefully vetoed those. And I assume or hope that some of the similar proposals will be back. One of the things that the bill would have done was would have eliminated parking mandates statewide for all residential uses, and that would have been really great for the reasons that I've talked about. But you also see in my home state of Texas, the legislature just passed a very large number of bills. And in the Texas legislature's view, it's a property rights argument, just like I imagine it should be or would be here in New Hampshire. That why are these local governments telling me as a property owner what I can do with my property? So bills on manufactured housing passed in Texas, bills legalizing accessory dwelling units and lifting a number of protections, a number of restrictions on housing, bills that shifted the minimum lot sizes, so reducing those minimum lot sizes down to 5,000 square feet, not 80,000 square feet in some jurisdictions. So it's you're seeing it across the political aisle. I expect that it'll continue. And it has to continue, I think, because you're not going to get 1,500 local zoning jurisdictions in New York State to pull in the same direction. Some of these don't even meet regularly, much less have an ideological point of view.
Thanks. New Hampshire actually legalized detached accessory dwelling units this year. Yay. And also one parking place per unit. So we're making progress.
Yes, I saw that. And I'll just add one thing. If you look on the zoning atlas, you will see what the local zoning codes say. So Ivy just mentioned a statewide override of accessory dwelling units. So those granny flats, in-law suites, whatever you want to call them, but the smaller units with single family housing. That is not going to show up on the zoning atlas. And we may show the state overrides in a toggle at some point. But the reason we're not showing, we're not simply overriding, is because we think that local zoning enforcement officers will be administering whatever their local code says, not necessarily what the state says. So we kind of want to show that there's a difference between what's happening at the local level and what the state is actually trying to tell these local governments to do.
That's a great segue into the next question, which is local zoning is administered by the code enforcement officer. Every town has one. Sometimes they share, well, most towns have one. Sometimes they borrow one from the next door town in New Hampshire. And this is true across the country. That's how zoning is enforced, is by this code officer. And the code officer is legally known as the authority having jurisdiction. Can you talk a little bit about the conflict between what the code is trying to do and how it's being enforced by the local code officer?
So this is a tough one. One of the things that we've seen in the zoning atlas work is that oftentimes, especially in smaller towns, there is a part-time official, if there is an official at all within local government. Oftentimes it's a consultant that may only work for 5 hours a week. You combine that on the drafting side and the sort of planning administration side, with a similar, we haven't looked at zoning enforcement officers or whether they're part-time or not or anything like that, but assuming that in a lot of these cases, you do have part-time or you do have, maybe a less, I'm not gonna say less professionalized, but a less sort of day-to-day presence on some of these issues, it does potentially lead to differences in enforcement, interpretations in the field that may not jive with what the zoning code says or what state law says, to speak to the last question. So, I guess I would just say we haven't done a thorough survey of that, but from what we've seen on the plan administration side, there are a lot of jurisdictions that simply don't have the staff to administer a code in an extremely rigorous way, let's just say, or extremely consistent way. And you see people doing a lot of different roles, too, at a town hall. And so that, I think, does suggest that there may be differences in the way a code is enforced and the way it's written. We don't have a way to log those yet, but we hope somebody does take that up.
Okay, new question. What do you think are the best innovations in producing more affordable housing?
Lifting parking mandates, reducing public eliminating public hearings, and giving people a say at the beginning when the rules are being written and not on individual zoning applications. Because once you get to the point where developers presenting plans to a local board and at a public hearing, and the plans have already seen investment, they've already done their return on investment calculations. Once it gets to that point, and the developer's plans have to change because of some opinion somebody said or some way, something that the commissioner ate that night for dinner, it creates an environment which is a turnoff to people who want to build the housing. So I think in general, so two very easy things, in my opinion, turn the public hearing process around, make it earlier, make the public input earlier, before a single project comes in, and eliminate parking mandates. Those are two. We also found in the zoning atlas that height caps are pretty common, and sometimes they'll say, oh, multifamily housing is allowed, but the building height can only be 2 stories. I wrote a paper called Zoning by 1,000 Cuts. You can get it for a free download, and it catalogs Connecticut's provisions like this and all of the different ways, lot coverage, height caps, FAR, and the prevalence of those. And height caps are prevalent in, I think, 85 to 90% of provisions, so height caps are another one. But again, I think the whole point of a zoning reform and changes that you see either at a local state level are to reset the playing field, to not make developers of housing the bad guys. They're the ones that are putting their money on the line to build the housing.
Well, we all know that real estate development is a black box full of money and bad intentions. So what processes did you use in Hartford to bring people from differing perspectives to come to awareness and agreement?
So I personally did 75, 100 meetings outside of the planning and zoning process. My general philosophy is, why does anybody want... I love meetings, actually. I love to go to meetings. I love doing the Planning and Zoning Commission meetings. Nobody else seems to love meetings, and nobody wants to haul down to City Hall on a Tuesday night to wait their turn to talk about whatever it is we think they want to talk about. So I went out to the community. There was no gathering of people. There was a, are you meeting? Then I will come to that meeting. Can I be on the agenda? And I did that for neighborhood groups, for community associations, for neighborhood revitalization organizations, for environmental groups, both locally and statewide. I gave presentations. I just went wherever anybody was gathering. It's like, if there's more than two of you gathering, right, we're in the church, then like I'm going to go try to be there. And that was the process. It was almost like the book all over again, or book preview, where I said, okay, guys, listen, there's this thing, it's called zoning. It's really bad right now, so like, let's try to figure out how to change it. And then taking provisions, for example, that Denise talked about, and showing where in the code that was going to change, showing the fast food line, it's now prohibited in her district, drive-thru is prohibited, gas stations prohibited. And just kind of connecting those dots by going back. So there was no gathering, there was only, I don't know, going.
So this is one that I think all of us who work in this area have run into. How do you address the conflicts that arrive between conservation boards, zoning, and zoning, in New Hampshire, they're called the Zoning Board of Adjustment. They're the quasi-judicial branch that says, yeah, that matches or it doesn't, and planning boards, because these boards have different focuses.
All right, so I'm gonna tell you a secret, which is Connecticut is the only state in the country where at the local level, the charter can give an unelected board, in our case, the Planning and Zoning Commission, full power to both draft and administer the zoning code without elected officials meddling, without the mayor, without anybody stepping in. We were one of the towns in Connecticut where that had happened, and nobody in my position before had ever taken advantage of that. And because I said, well, how do you have to get this approved? Well, it's your commission's job. So that way, then I started the Word document, and okay, let's write the code, right? So we didn't have that issue in Connecticut because the Planning and Zoning Commission both was responsible for the plan and writing the zoning code, administering the zoning code, telling the Zoning Board of Appeals what their responsibilities and limitations were, and we were also the Inland Wetlands and Watercourses Commission. So everything was like a one-stop shop. I would encourage New Hampshire to think about how that might work here. We see the diverse commissions giving, you know, different people a chance to weigh in, but oftentimes those commissions are understaffed, not from the professional city or town side, but from the commissioner side. They may not have the educational tools they need, the professional development they need to actually decide on the things that they're deciding on. And I think the dispersion of power leads to stagnation, leads to projects not getting built, it leads to applicant confusion, it leads to costs. That's probably especially true when it comes to multifamily housing, but it's probably true for other things too. So I think, you know, as much as I love the New England, every town, every commission, everybody needs a voice, the idea of consolidating in favor of the public good, some of these processes and some of these commissions, I think is a really good thing. I would also say having a commission that was in many ways immune from the public political process, as ours was in Hartford, was the only way any of this happened. If I had to explain every single, like these are the list of trees, what, you know, to every city council's legislative aide, we would never have gotten it done. We passed that code unanimously in one night in a city of 125,000 people. Once it was drafted, it had gone through the process, people came, I said, just come to the one meeting and testify. They came to the one meeting, they testified, we passed it. We would have never done that if we had to go through the city council and deal with all of that. And it's a good code, and if I do say so myself.
I will say in support of that plea that in New Hampshire, the places that have actually enacted progressive zoning codes are the towns where the vote doesn't go to town meeting. New Market, New Hampshire just adopted a really nice, I love it, a really nice form-based code for their state highway spine. That was adopted by the city council. It didn't go to town meeting. This is true in Somersworth, it's true in Lebanon, it's true in most of the places that have made significant change. So that's a data point for you. I have another question for you. How do zoning codes influence market values, thus assessment, thus property tax rates?
Yeah, so zoning dictates what can be built, and it tells you how much housing, for example, can be built, whether property can have a mix of uses, whether you have to satisfy certain requirements, how much of the land you can build between setbacks and lot coverage requirements. So zoning has a lot to say just about the amount of building and the amount of stuff you can put on any single lot. So certainly it has a lot to do with property values. In those places that have legalized, let's say, 2, 3, and 4 unit housing across what were single family neighborhoods, those property values have tended to risen not a lot of development necessarily happens right away. People are not tearing down their single-family homes for fourplexes, as they call them, immediately. But over time, it's the opportunity that allows for the more housing where those lots are redeveloped, those improve in value too.
Okay, here's one. I think this might be our last one. It's complicated. Ezra Klein argues in his book, Abundance, that yesterday's solution become today's problems, and zoning is one of these. It's easy to add regulation and hard to subtract, but that may be needed for some small towns. How do we do that?
New Hampshire's zoning codes as a whole are not as complicated as some codes. I'll give you the example of Maine, where we spent 2 solid months or more mired in Washington County because the length and complexity of their codes was, it was insane, actually. 45 jurisdictions in Washington County, 45 jurisdictions in a county with 30,000 people. 45 separate zoning authorities, thousands of pages of zoning codes, and often 2 zoning codes, a regular code and a shoreland zoning code. So I will just say, in praise of New Hampshire, your codes are not as bad as others. But simplicity always is better for the public. It's better for zoning administrators. It's better for the zoning enforcement officers. Simplicity in service of something, and we're seeing as we look, continue to look at jurisdictions around the country, we do see patterns of accretion, patterns of, we'll just add this one more zone, this one more overlay, and in service of what is really the question. So I guess I'll just, if this is the last question, I'll just say, I think in many cases, people are reluctant to change zoning codes because they think, well, this is, if we change it, then what could happen? Anything could happen. But oftentimes, what they're accepting is a zoning code that was in place for decades, has never been questioned, hasn't been changed in decades, and whose fundamental principles are actually at odds with what a community wants to see. It's my impression, for example, that people in New Hampshire like the natural environment. Well, then why is it that the vast majority of land in the state is requiring people to drive, requiring you to, again, push into farmland, push into forest land? The root of that is zoning. That is what's messing up your commitment, is at odds with your commitment to your natural environment. So if that's the case, then it's a fundamental principle that's embedded within these local rules that needs to just be completely rethought. And how you do that, whether you allow cluster developments, whether you allow, there was a great story in the New York Times about a development in East Texas where a number of retired women were living in small lots on tiny homes in a co-housing. That's illegal in most places in New Hampshire, I would bet. But that's how people want to live. So I think let your imagination carry forward some of these reforms and distill it down to the principles and the ways you would like your community to develop.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, one of the things that has happened in Peterborough is that we added a zone that allows 5,000 square foot lots, which has, the last time I counted, allowed the construction of something in the order of 60 new small houses on small lots. I have one further, this really is the last question. You want to talk about building code versus zoning code? That came up in a couple of questions. It's something that gets talked about in our circles. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Sure. It would sure would be nice if the people who wrote building codes would harmonize those rules with the people who wrote zoning codes. But in a nutshell, zoning codes articulate the rules for sort of the envelope, I guess you would say, where building codes say what happens in the walls of the building, how it's held up, and the technical details. So as an architect, so I am an architect, although I don't really practice, but an architect would look not only at the zoning code to see, is this allowed, is it not allowed, what are the rules, the setbacks, the height caps, and all of that, but then look at the zoning code for that, but then we'll look at the building code too and say, well then how can I get this done? One of the hot topics in building code discussions right now is whether larger buildings, up to 4, 6, 8, or 10 units, depending on the community, should have to have 2 sets of stairwells. Having two sets of stairwells raises costs and may or may not be necessary according to the arguments of those who are trying to say eliminate the second stairwell. Another big argument in zoning codes is sustainability and how sustainability features can be integrated into buildings. So if you have a zoning code that's very sustainable and has all the stuff that I had talked about in Hartford, I didn't talk about solar, but we did stuff on solar and electric vehicles and stormwater management and native trees and all of that, then what do you do if you can only build conventional buildings? So those two have to match. They're adopted differently. Zoning codes are the local boards. Building codes are International Code Council, which is adopted by the state, and then each government adopts those as well. But the template is done at a very, very high level.
New Hampshire actually did adopt single stair this year, up to four stories. Thank you so much,
Thank
Sarah.
You.
This is, I hope you guys had as much fun as I did.